parted to cherry blossoms, or cloud formations, or human features, as a result of their inevitably fleeting time on Earth. It's only stretching this concept slightly to suggest that Sherry feels the same way about, for example, the cartons of morning banana juice in her care, or about Fortune Snookies, a short-lived line of fortune cookies for dogs. Every failure, the way she sees it, embodies its own sad story of sincere effort on the part of designers, marketers, salespeople, and others. It's never far from her mind that real people had their mortgages, their car payments, and their family holidays riding on the success of Touch of Yogurt or Fortune Snookies. Or of Hubline Wine and Dine Dinners, a line of pre-prepared meals packaged with a half-size bottle of cooking wine, which customers, understandably, assumed was meant for drinking. Then they tasted the wine, and then they stopped buying Hubline Wine and Dine Dinners. "I feel really sorry for the developer on this one," Sherry said, indicating the breath mints that inadvertently resembled crack. "I mean, I've met the guy. Why would he ever have spent any time on the streets, in the drug culture? He did everything right, except to go out on the streets to see if his product looked like drugs." She shook her head. "To me, it takes incredible courage to be a product developer. There are so many ways it could go wrong. These are real people who get up every morning and sincerely want to do their best, and then, well, things happen." The Museum of Failed Products was itself a kind of accident, albeit a happier one. Its creator, a now retired marketing man named Robert McMath, merely intended to accumulate a reference library of consumer products, not failures per se. Starting in the 1960s, he began purchasing and preserving a sample of every new item he could find. He usually emptied out any perishable contents to stop things getting disgusting. Soon, the collection outgrew his office in upstate New York, and he was forced to move into a converted granary to accommodate it. Later, GFK, the initials are derived from the German name of its parent company, bought him out, moving the whole lot to Michigan. What McMath hadn't taken into account, he told me on the phone from his home in California, was the three-word truth that was to prove the making of his career. Most products fail. According to some estimates, the failure rate is as high as 90%. Simply by collecting new products indiscriminately, McMath had ensured that his hoard would come to consist overwhelmingly of unsuccessful ones. "You know, I never really liked the term Museum of Failed Products," he told me. "But there it is. It stuck. There wasn't much I could do about it." I suspected him of being a little disingenuous about this, since all the evidence suggests that McMath reveled in his reputation as a guru of failure. In the early years, he was a fixture on the lecture circuit, and then on American cable television. David Letterman even interviewed him about what McMath was happy to refer to as his library of losers. He wrote a marketing manual, What Were They Thinking?, devoted largely to poking fun at products such as Revlon's No Sweat Antiperspirant and Look of Buttermilk, a companion product to Clairol's Touch of Yogurt. As McMath points out, you should never mention sweat when marketing anti-sweat products because shoppers find it repulsive. It's entirely unclear, meanwhile, what the look of buttermilk might be, let alone why you might wish your hair to sport it. But Sherry seemed disapproving of the levity with which her predecessor had approached his work. "Originally, yes, the hook with the media was that he was the owner of a museum of failures," she sighed. "But I think that's just a shame. It's human to point fingers and revel in someone else's misery, I guess. But I just feel very attached to everything in here." She had a point. True, I laughed when I encountered Goff's low-ash cat food, with its proud boast, "contains only 1.5% ash." As the journalist Neil Steinberg has noted, this is like marketing a line of hot dogs called Few Mouse Hairs. Yet several people presumably invested months of their lives in creating that cat food. I hope they can look back and chuckle about it now, but who knows? By far the most striking thing about the Museum of Failed Products, though, has to do with the fact that it exists as a viable profit-making business in the first place. You might have assumed that any consumer product manufacturer worthy of the name would have its own such collection, a carefully stewarded resource to help it avoid repeating errors its rivals had already made. Yet the executives arriving every week at Carol Sherry's door are evidence of how rarely this happens. Product developers are so focused on their next hoped-for success, and so unwilling to invest time or energy in thinking about their industry's past failures, that they only belatedly realize how much they need and are willing to pay to access GfK's collection. Most surprising of all is the fact that many of the designers who have found their way to the Museum of Failed Products over the years have come there in order to examine, or alternatively have been surprised to discover, products that their own companies had created and then abandoned. These firms were apparently so averse to thinking about the unpleasant business of failure that they had neglected even to keep samples of their own disasters. "Here's how it usually goes," said McMath. "A product will be developed by a product manager, and it won't work out, and he'll probably just keep a few in his bedroom closet for sentimental value, but then he'll eventually leave the company. The product may now no longer exist anywhere except in the manager's bedroom. Nor, of course, will he bring examples of his failures to his next place of work. Why voluntarily associate yourself with misfires? People are inspired by success and achievement, and marketing people are as human as anyone," said Sherry. "You want to be able to tell a good story about your accomplishments. It's unlikely that many people at his former firm will want to dwell on what went wrong either. Failure simply isn't a topic on which ambitious people wish to spend much of their time. At best, it's just depressing. At worst, it feels somehow infectious, as if the germs of disaster might infect your next project. Recall the message of Dr. Robert H. Schuller at Get Motivated, instructing his audience to cut the word impossible out of their vocabularies and to refuse to contemplate the possibility of failure. The very fact that the consumer products industry needs a museum of failed products indicates that many product designers and marketing executives have done exactly that." McMath turned a little coy when I asked him to tell me which executives, specifically, had found themselves compelled to visit his collection, Tails Between Legs, to examine their own company's products, though after some pestering he let it be known that some of them might have worked for a multinational beginning with P and ending in Rockter & Gamble. But he did vividly remember one product design team who approached him with a plan to market two companion lines of sex-specific nappies for boys and girls, with the padding configured differently in each. This turns out to have been an often attempted, often abandoned innovation. Parents generally don't see the need, while retailers resent having to use up more shelf space in order to avoid running out of either kind. It was with glee that Robert McMath ushered the designers to an aisle in his collection to show them not only that their idea had already been tried, but that it had been their own firm that had tried it. Failure is everywhere. It's just that most of the time we would rather avoid confronting that fact. Failure and our fraught relationship to it is a theme that has been playing in the background of much of this book so far. It's the thing that the culture of positive thinking strives at all costs to avoid, so it should come as little surprise that it should be so central to an alternative approach to happiness. The Stoic technique of negative visualization is precisely about turning towards the possibility of failure. The critics of goal setting are effectively proposing a new attitude towards failure, too, since an improvisational trial-and-error approach necessarily entails being frequently willing to fail. The spiritual ruminations of Eckhart Tolle and Alan Watts, meanwhile, point to an even deeper kind of failure, the ultimate and ultimately liberating failure of the ego's efforts to maintain its separation and security. But it's also worth considering the subject of failure directly, in order to see how the desperate efforts of the cult of optimism to avoid it are so often counterproductive, and how we might be better off learning to embrace it. The first reason to turn towards failure is that our efforts not to think about failure leave us with a severely distorted understanding of what it takes to be successful. The second is that an openness to the emotional experience of failure can be a stepping stone to a much richer kind of happiness than can be achieved by focusing only on success. It has become fashionable in some circles to insist upon the importance of embracing failure. No autobiography of a high-profile entrepreneur or politician or inventor is complete without several passages in which the author attributes his or her success to a willingness to fail. Sir Richard Branson is a repeat offender in this regard. But truly embracing failure entails a shift in perspective far greater than what most such figures mean when they pay lip service to the notion. And in any case, heeding only the advice of the successful is a big part of the problem. Our resistance to thinking about failure is especially curious in light of the fact that failure is so ubiquitous. Failure is the distinguishing feature of corporate life, writes the economist Paul Ormerod at the start of his book Why Most Things Fail. But in this sense, corporate life is merely a microcosm of the whole of life. Evolution itself is driven by failure. We think of it as a matter of survival and adaptation, but it makes equal sense to think of it as a matter of not surviving and not adapting. Or perhaps more sense. Of all the species that have ever existed, after all, fewer than 1% of them survive today. The others failed. On an individual level, too, no matter how much success you may experience in life, your eventual story, no offence intended, will be one of failure. Your bodily organs will fail, and you'll die. Yet though failure is ubiquitous, psychologists have long recognised that we find this notion appalling, and that we will go to enormous lengths to avoid thinking about it. At its pathological extreme, this fear of failure is known as cacaraphiophobia, the symptoms of which can include heart palpitations, hyperventilation, and dizziness. Few of us suffer so acutely. But as we'll see, this may only be because we are so naturally skilled at editing out our failures in order to retain a memory of our actions that is vastly more flattering than the reality. Like product managers with failures stuffed into a bedroom closet, we will do anything to tell a success-based story of our lives. This leads, among other consequences, to the entertaining psychological phenomenon known as illusory superiority. This mental glitch explains why, for example, the vast majority of people tell researchers that they consider themselves to be in the top 50% of safe drivers, even though they couldn't possibly all be. Like many commentators concerned about our reluctance to confront failure, Robert McMath likes to argue that we should behave more like scientists. The implication is that scientists, unlike the rest of us, must by necessity learn to become more comfortable with failure. Professional scientists, not surprisingly, tend to share this flattering view. The goal of every good scientist is discovering the truth, so he can't be picky about whether the results of his experiments confirm or undermine his hypotheses. Scientific research involves devising a hypothesis, testing it, and then dealing with whatever results you obtain, even if they ruin your hopes of a prize-winning breakthrough, right? Actually, maybe not. A fascinating series of studies of working scientists, conducted by the Irish-born researcher Kevin Dunbar, presents a very different picture, and confirms just how deeply and universally human the tendency to avoid confronting failure really is. Scientists, it transpires, may be just as bad as everyone else. Dunbar negotiated access to 4 leading molecular biology laboratories and began observing the work that was conducted there. For months, he videotaped interviews and recorded the weekly lab meetings at which researchers discussed their findings. This kind of examination of what scientists do on a day-to-day basis is rare, not least because scientists themselves frequently dismiss it as irrelevant. Dunbar's first discovery was that the researchers encountered failure all the time. "If you're a scientist and you're doing an experiment," he said later, "about half the experiments that you do actually turn out wrong. For whatever reason, faulty procedures or a flawed hypothesis, the results obtained did not mesh with the conclusions towards which the scientists believed they were advancing." As one of Dunbar's subjects put it in a meeting, describing yet another failure, "I saw the results and I wanted to throw myself off a bridge." Things got more interesting when Dunbar examined how the researchers responded to this deluge of failure. As he told an interviewer from Wired magazine, their reactions followed a predictable sequence. First, a scientist would blame his equipment or techniques, suspecting that a measuring device must be malfunctioning or that he himself had made a stupid mistake. If the problem couldn't be explained away so easily, the researcher would then repeat the experiment, sometimes several times, in hopes that the anomaly would vanish. And if that didn't work, he would often simply put the experiment aside. Laboratories are busy places. Scientists are overworked. There are vastly more potential avenues for research than could ever be pursued, and so researchers have to make choices about what they'll focus on next. Consistently, Kevin Dunbar found, they chose to neglect their inexplicable results, focusing on their successes and avoiding dwelling upon their failures. Using brain imaging, Dunbar has examined the part of the human brain that seems most implicated in screening out failure, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, or DLPFC. This region plays a crucial role in filtering out irrelevant or unwanted incoming information, which is essential if you want to concentrate, say, on a single conversation at a noisy cocktail party. People with damaged DLPFCs experience difficulty with such tasks. but a similar filtering process appears to be triggered when we're presented with information that violates our expectations, even when it's far from irrelevant. In one experiment, Dunbar showed videos to an audience of physics students in which two objects of different sizes, dropped from the top of a tower, appeared to behave in defiance of the laws of gravity. They fell at different speeds. Physics students know that's not what really happens, and their DLPFCs lit up, much more so than was the case in viewers of the video who weren't so familiar with this law of physics. Dunbar's hunch is that the physics students' brains were reacting to the unwanted, clearly inexplicable information by attempting to delete it from their awareness. Back in Ann Arbor, at the Museum of Failed Products, it wasn't hard to imagine how a similar aversion to confronting failure might have been responsible for the very existence of many of the products lining its shelves. Each one must have made it through a series of meetings at which nobody realized that the product was doomed. Perhaps nobody wanted to contemplate the prospect of failure. Perhaps someone did, but didn't want to bring it up for discussion. Even if the product's likely failure was recognized, Robert McMath explained, those responsible for marketing it might well have responded by ploughing more money into it. This is a common reaction when a product looks like it's going to be a lemon, since with a big enough marketing spend, a marketing manager can at least guarantee a few sales, sparing the company total humiliation. By the time reality sets in, McMath notes in What Were They Thinking, it's quite possible that the executives will have been promoted to another brand or recruited by another company. Thanks to a collective unwillingness to face up to failure, more money will have been invested in the doomed project, and little energy will have been dedicated to examining what went wrong. Everyone involved will have conspired, perhaps without realizing what they're doing, never to think or speak of it again. The first big problem with our reluctance to think about or analyze failure, whether our own or other people's, is that it leads to an utterly distorted picture of the causes of success. Some years ago, a management theorist from Oxford University named Jerker Denrell was attending an academic conference in Stockholm, in his native Sweden, and sitting through the kind of speech that can make it hard to stay awake. Up at the podium, a fellow researcher was explaining his findings about the personality traits of highly successful entrepreneurs. According to several new case studies, the speaker announced, high achievers demonstrated two key characteristics. They were willing to persevere in the face of setbacks, and they possessed enough charisma to convince others to follow them. All of which is boringly obvious, and it's easy to imagine eyelids across the conference hall beginning to droop. But Denrell found himself paying attention. The speech he was hearing, he realized, embodied an error that he had been encountering for some time. He'd just never heard it so clearly expressed. It was a mistake so basic that it threatened to undermine a large proportion of his colleagues' work. It may well be true that successful entrepreneurs possess perseverance and leadership skills, of course. What's less obvious, and much less boring, is what the speaker neglected to mention, that those traits are likely to be the characteristics of extremely unsuccessful people, too. Think about it, Denrell observed afterwards. Incurring large losses requires both persistence and the ability to persuade others to pour their money down the drain. People without much perseverance or charisma are more likely to end up in the middle, experiencing neither great success nor great failure. If you never stick at anything, and if you can't persuade others to follow you, you may never lead an army of like-minded souls to a stunning victory, but neither will you lead them off a cliff. It seems entirely likely that the very successful and the very unsuccessful might actually have rather similar personalities. The only indisputable difference between the two is that the very unsuccessful are much, much less frequently interviewed by management scholars who are studying the causes of success. They are, after all, failures. Even if researchers wanted to interview them, which by and large they don't, it's hard to imagine how they might track them down in significant numbers. Success happens in public. Indeed, achieving celebrity is part of many people's definition of what constitutes success. Failure is occasionally spectacular at first, but people who fail dwell largely in obscurity. This problem, which is known as survivor bias or the undersampling of failure, is already extremely familiar in many areas of scholarship and of life. Most of us grasp it intuitively in certain contexts, of which the canonical example is gambling. We know deep down not to conclude that if we've enjoyed a winning streak at the roulette table, we must possess some magical ability to predict the behaviour of the roulette wheel. We understand that winning at roulette is a matter of chance, and that probability dictates that winning streaks will sometimes occur. Losing streaks are more common, of course, It's just that they don't tend to cause any intrigued whispering around the casino. You never hear about all the men and women who didn't break the bank at Monte Carlo. The speech that Jerker Denrell heard in Stockholm was one glaring example of how our conversations about success are always falling foul of the undersampling of failure. But there are countless others. Take the best-selling book The Millionaire Next Door by the American researcher Thomas Stanley. This purports to be a research-based portrait of the millionaire personality, and though the jacket describes its conclusions as surprising, they really aren't. The typical millionaire, Stanley reveals, is disciplined and driven, street smart but not necessarily intellectual, and frugal to the point of tight-fistedness. The Millionaire Next Door, its publishers claim, shattered one of contemporary America's most firmly held myths, that wealthy individuals belong to an elite group of the highly educated and exceedingly lucky, who often inherit their money and spend it on lavish purchases and pampered lifestyles. The implication throughout, and surely the explanation for the book's commercial success, is that if you, too, were to become self-disciplined, street-smart and frugal, you, too, could make a million. Except that knowing what we know about survivor bias, that doesn't necessarily follow at all. Judging by his own account of his research, Stanley spent no time whatsoever studying the personalities of those who had tried but failed to become millionaires, or those to whom the notion had never occurred. To be fair, he does mention people who made a fortune but didn't manage to hold on to their money. And so he has few grounds for concluding that frugality or self-discipline, or any other trait for that matter, is part of the recipe for becoming a millionaire. Others who were equally frugal or self-disciplined might have come nowhere near millionairehood. Suppose you look at successful chief executives and you find that they all brush their teeth, Denrell told me. Well, you realize that this isn't a thing unique to chief executives because everybody brushes their teeth. You know this because you brush your teeth too, so you dismiss it. But say they have some strange trait that you don't have much experience of. Well, it will seem to you that this is something that explains their success. It seems to make sense, after all. And it feels intuitively right to be focusing on the successful, not on the failures. If you want to learn how to fly, you look at birds, you don't look at cockroaches. But focusing solely on success leads us badly astray. One of the more peculiar consequences of the survivor bias is the way that it casts doubt not only on the work of scholars who study success, but on the explanations that successful people themselves give, and may sincerely believe, for their own achievements. Bookshops are stuffed with autobiographical volumes of advice such as the one released in 2006 by the multimillionaire publisher Felix Dennis, entitled How to Get Rich, The Distilled Wisdom of One of Britain's Wealthiest Self-Made Entrepreneurs. Dennis's book is far less annoying than most such works, thanks largely to his disarming sense of humour about being worth £700 million, and his refreshing honesty about how much he enjoys the yachts and Caribbean holidays and Michelin-starred food that his lifestyle affords him. And yet beneath the bragging, his book conveys a similar message to many of the others. To make a fortune, you need stubbornness, a lack of regard for what other people think of you, and a willingness to take risks. Those qualities, Dennis suggests, made him what he is. To which Jerker Denrell might respond, how could he possibly know? Dennis, obviously, has lived only one life and has no experience of an alternative one, culminating in financial failure with which to compare it. Perhaps thousands of others exhibited the same determination, cheekiness and pluck, but got nowhere. Maybe not. Maybe Dennis's ascent was due to dumb luck or to some other personality trait, so that he actually succeeded in spite of his stubbornness or fondness for risks. His self-diagnosis may be correct, of course. It's just that he isn't automatically in a better position than anyone else to say. Dennis's focus on risk-taking raises an intriguing additional point, which is that the willingness to fail is itself one of the personality traits we may come to overvalue as a result of survivor bias. This is the problem with homilies such as those of Richard Branson, who writes, "Being unafraid of failure is, I believe, one of the most important qualities of a champion." He may be right about the importance of not fearing failure, but then again, you don't hear speeches or read autobiographies by people who are unafraid of failure and then did indeed simply fail. A willingness to fail might not be associated with success at all. Alternatively, as Denrell points out, a willingness to court failure by taking big risks might be correlated with both great success and great failure. The definition of a big risk, after all, is that it carries a significant likelihood of things not working out. A parallel insight arises from Denrell's research into media commentators who make predictions about the future course of the economy. The ones who made the most extreme, headline-grabbing predictions, Denrell and his colleague Christina Fang concluded, were just as likely to prove astonishingly wrong as astonishingly right. They weren't better forecasters, they just made riskier forecasts. While the media, which trumpeted their predictions and praised them when they were vindicated by events, rarely followed up on their failed forecasts. This is something you might wish to consider before relying on such commentators when choosing where to invest your money. It's worth bearing in mind, moreover, that virtually any advice about how to succeed, in life or work, is at constant risk of being undermined by survivor bias. We ignore or avoid failure so habitually that we rarely stop to consider all the people who may have followed any set of instructions for happiness or success, including those advanced in these pages, but then failed to achieve the result. This is probably as good a time as any to tell you about my pubic louse. I acquired the louse, just the one, though it was exceptionally large, in February 2001 at Greenwich in East London, at the site of the Millennium Dome, Britain's fabled monument to the dawn of the year 2000. The story of the dome is, notoriously, one of failure after failure. A financial catastrophe, a disaster in terms of visitor numbers, and the undoing of several prominent politicians' careers. By early 2001, the Millennium Experience, the exhibition that had occupied the interior of the 365-metre-wide marquee for the previous year, had ended. I had been sent, as a newspaper reporter, to witness the auction of the dome's contents, by means of which its now bankrupt operators hoped to recover some fraction of their lost millions. I'd been given £100 of my employer's petty cash in order to make a purchase for the purposes of entertaining journalism. The serious money, it was clear, was going to be spent on the company's computers, its high-tech lighting rigs and catering equipment. But everything was up for grabs, including the exhibits that had dominated the dome's 14 zones, dedicated to such topics as body, mind, faith, work, money, and play. The body zone was a giant replica of a human body, bigger, we'd often been told, than the Statue of Liberty, through which visitors, although not enough of them, had walked. Demonstrating an audacious refusal to flinch from the unpalatable realities of their subject, the body's designers had equipped it with several mechanized pubic lice. With my £100, I bought one. The others went to an antiques dealer from Surrey, who told me he planned to use them to scare his wife and children. A man must have a hobby. A dome employee named Jeff came to help me extract my louse from the storeroom. "It's a bit sad, really," he said, with what seemed to be real emotion. "I used to work with this guy." I took the creature to the processing desk, as required, where another worker took it from me and handed me a slip of paper. "I wouldn't be able to take it off the premises," she explained, "until the auction was completed in a few days' time. Rules were rules." I returned to the office, louseless and in a reflective mood. The auction had felt like a public admission of the dome's defeat, and thus an appropriate end to the whole saga. Sad, but also funny, and above all, fitting. The sorry story of the dome is probably best encapsulated by Dan Howland, an expert on fairgrounds and amusement parks, who expresses it as follows in a monograph entitled Dome and Domer. From the moment it opened, it was clear that the Millennium Dome would be one of the grandest and most spectacular failures in exposition history. It was unpopular with both press and public, inaccessible, ill-conceived, poorly planned, mismanaged, and just generally dull. So much money was spent on the dome, and so much more shovelled in as the debacle continued, that Labour Prime Minister Tony Blair found his career hanging in the balance, while other Labour officials found their careers hanging in tatters. The story of the Millennium Dome is a tale of honest mistakes, bad design, hubris, stupidity, greed, corruption. But above all, it's a tale of something so monumentally awful that it takes on a sort of soggy grandeur. There's no need to rehearse each of these missteps here. Among the more famous lowlights were the New Year's Eve 1999 opening ceremony, when thousands of invited guests, including influential politicians and national newspaper editors, were forced to shiver outdoors for hours before being funneled through the dome's hopelessly inadequate number of metal detectors. The bomb threat that almost forced the building's evacuation that night, and the attempted heist later that year, during which a team of thieves smashed their way inside with a digger and got halfway through executing the robbery of the world's second-largest flawless diamond, which they believed was inside. Technically, this may not count as a low point for the dome, since the heist was thwarted, An informant had alerted police, who had replaced the diamond with a replica and were lying in wait. The problems had started much earlier, though. In the years approaching the millennium, many of the project's senior employees and consultants had resigned, and several chief executives had been fired. One of them subsequently told a parliamentary committee that the dome's highest-level staff had been on the verge of nervous breakdowns as 2000 approached, forcing him to hire a team of counsellors. The dome was so vast, we'd been informed, that it could hold 18,000 double-decker London buses. But the consensus among commentators seemed to be that ordering a large quantity of double-decker buses might have been a much better use of the more than £800 million that the project swallowed up. The Millennium Dome, in other words, could hardly have been more of a catastrophe. And yet it also illustrated the extraordinary power of failure to bring people closer together. The atmosphere at the auction was surprisingly convivial, reflecting not just the schadenfreude of journalists, but an attitude that seemed to have accompanied the tale of the dome from the very beginning, a sort of affectionate, popular embrace of the endeavour in all its haplessness. "It's a souvenir of a national disaster," one attendee at the auction told me, explaining his presence there. "It's a very British thing to do, isn't it?" In the months following the auction, as politicians and commentators debated what should become of the now-empty dome, the columnist Roz Coward ably captured this bittersweet British fondness for its failure. This was not joy at the misfortune of others, so much as a perverse pride in belonging to the nation whose failure the dome had been. "The dome," she wrote, "has a clear brand, and that brand is disaster. It cries out to be exploited as a grand folly, an emblem of muddle, hype and plain foolishness with enormous entertainment potential. We've become fond of the building we love to hate, the great folly, with all the entertainment it has provided, stumbling from crisis to disaster. Something about it chimes with the British character. We're good at disasters, at not taking ourselves seriously and delighting when things go magnificently and foolishly wrong. This is the key to its future. It should become a museum of disasters and follies, a history of doomed projects or unfortunate accidents." That never happened, of course. These days, the Dome is the O2 Arena, a concert venue that occasionally plays host to stadium-sized motivational seminars. A few days after the auction, I returned to Greenwich to collect my pubic louse, but it was nowhere to be found. The dome employee who helped me look for it was apologetic, but not surprised. Even in attempting to sell off its contents, the dome proved a failure. Over the next few years, I received sporadic letters from the accountants PricewaterhouseCoopers, who were handling the bankruptcy, implying that one day, presumably after more important creditors had been recompensed, I might get my newspaper's £100 back. I'm still waiting. This half-embrace of failure, as Coward suggests, is something the British like to think of as distinctly British. We celebrate Captain Scott's failed and fatal effort to be the first to the South Pole. We cherish the spirit of the Dunkirk evacuation more than the triumph of victory. "To all those who have written terrible books on success," wrote the British journalist Stephen Pyle in his 1979 bestseller in Britain, The Book of Heroic Failures, "I dedicate this terrible book on how it's perfectly all right to be incompetent, because I am and so is everyone I know." To citizens of the success-oriented United States, the fondness for failure can seem like a more generally European eccentricity, frequently attributed to the end of empire. "Musing over failure is not a particularly American activity," writes the journalist Neil Steinberg. "Sure, it's big in Europe, where every nation at one time or another has had a lock on greatness, only to fritter it away, smothering monster palaces in gold leaf and commissioning jewelled Fabergé eggs by the dozen. England had her empire, Spain her armada, France her Napoleon, Germany its unspeakable zenith. Even Belgium had a moment of glory, though, true, things haven't been quite the same since the death of Charles the Bold in 1477. For those nations, remembering and bitterly analysing greatness are just about their only connection to it anymore. Why do you think they have all those pubs and outdoor cafes?" But we shouldn't write off the embrace of failure as a culturally specific quirk. In the context of the negative path to happiness, there's more to say. We've seen already how a willingness to fail and to analyse past failures can be crucial to understanding achievement and success. But a more deeply counterintuitive possibility is that there is happiness to be found in embracing failure as failure, not just as a path to success. that welcoming it might simply feel better than perpetually struggling to avoid it. There's an openness and honesty in failure, a down-to-earth confrontation with reality that is lacking at the higher altitudes of success. To achieve something impressive, as might have happened had the dome ever become, as Tony Blair predicted, a beacon to the world, is necessarily to erect a kind of barrier between yourself and everyone else. To be impressed by something, meanwhile, implies feeling yourself to be in the presence of something different from and better than yourself. Failure, by contrast, collapses these boundaries, demonstrating the fallibility of those who might otherwise try to present themselves as immune to defeat. It cuts people down to human size. The vulnerability revealed by failure can nurture empathy and communality. Do you feel more or less connection to the people who ran the dome to learn that they had been on the brink of emotional collapse? The answer, surely, is more. Had the dome been a triumphant success, it would have been unthinkable for a reporter to have had the conversations I found myself having with its employees, who would have been uptight and wary, instructed not to communicate with the media except in ways that might burnish the brand. "Psychologically, I suppose, it's healthy," said one security guard, who was keeping watch over four life-sized mannequins in surgical dress that would eventually sell for £320. "We've come to the funeral, we've buried the body, and we're grieving. Failure is a relief. At last you can say what you think." Still, it can be exceptionally hard to adopt this attitude towards your own failures. As Christopher Kayes' notion of goal odyssey suggests, we too often make our goals into parts of our identities, so that failure becomes an attack on who we are. Or as Albert Ellis understood, we alight upon some desired outcome, being happily married, for example, or finding fulfilling work, and elevate it into one we feel we must attain, so that failing at it becomes not just sad, but catastrophic. To use the Buddhist language of attachment and non-attachment, we become attached to success. All these counterproductive ways of thinking about failure manifest themselves most acutely in the phenomenon of perfectionism. This is one of those traits that many people seem secretly or not so secretly proud to possess, since it hardly seems like a character flaw. Yet perfectionism, at bottom, is a fear-driven striving to avoid the experience of failure at all costs. At its extremes, it is an exhausting and permanently stressful way to live. There is a greater correlation between perfectionism and suicide, research suggests, than between feelings of hopelessness and suicide. To fully embrace the experience of failure, not merely to tolerate it as a stepping stone to success, is to abandon this constant straining never to put a foot wrong. It is to relax. "Downfall," writes the American Zen Buddhist Natalie Goldberg, "brings us to the ground, facing the nitty-gritty, things as they are with no glitter. Success cannot last forever. Everyone's time runs out." She goes on, "Achievement solidifies us. Believing we're invincible, we want more and more. To see and feel things as they really are, we have to crash. Only then can we drop through to a more authentic self. Zen transmits its legacy from this deeper place. It is a different kind of failure, the great failure, a boundless surrender. Nothing to hold on to, and nothing to lose." Fortunately, it may be possible to cultivate some of this attitude towards failure without reaching the rarefied heights of Buddhist enlightenment. The work of the Stanford University psychologist Carol Dweck suggests that our experiences of failure are influenced overwhelmingly by the implicit beliefs we hold about the nature of talent and ability, and that we can, perhaps quite easily, nudge ourselves in the direction of a more healthy outlook. Each of us can be placed somewhere on a continuum, Dweck argues, depending on our implicit view, or unspoken attitude, about what talent is and where it comes from. Those with a fixed theory assume that ability is innate. Those with an incremental theory believe that it evolves through challenge and hard work. If you're the kind of person who struggles mightily to avoid the experience of failure, it's likely that you reside near the fixed end of Dweck's continuum. Fixed theory people tend to approach challenges as occasions on which they're called upon to demonstrate their innate abilities, and so they find failure especially horrifying. To them, it's a sign that they tried to show how good they were, but didn't measure up. The classic example of a person with a fixed theory is the young sports star who is encouraged to think of himself as a natural, but who then fails to put in sufficient practice to realize his potential. If talent is innate, his unspoken reasoning goes, then why bother? Incremental theory people are different. Because they think of abilities as emerging through tackling challenges, the experience of failure has a completely different meaning for them. It's evidence that they're stretching themselves to their current limit. If they weren't, they wouldn't fail. The relevant analogy here is with weight training. Muscles grow by being pushed to the limits of their current capacity, where fibers tear and reheal. Among weightlifters, training to failure isn't an admission of defeat. It's a strategy. Happily, Dweck's studies indicate that we're not saddled for life with one mindset rather than another. A little confusingly, the fixed mindset is not itself fixed, but can be shifted towards the incremental end of the continuum. Some people manage to alter their outlook simply by being introduced to the fixed versus incremental distinction. Alternatively, it's worth trying to recall it when failure strikes. Next time you flunk an exam or mishandle a social situation, consider that it's happening only because you're pushing at the limits of your present abilities, and therefore, over the long run, improving them. Should you wish to encourage an incremental outlook rather than a fixed one in your children, Dweck advises, take care to praise them for their effort rather than for their intelligence. Focusing on the latter is likely to exacerbate a fixed mindset, making them more reluctant to risk encountering failure in the future. The incremental mindset is the one most likely to lead to success, but a more profound point is that possessing an incremental outlook is a happier way to be, even if it never results in any particularly outstanding success. It allows you to abandon the stressful and tiring struggle of perfectionism. It's a win-win proposition, for which the only precondition is a heartfelt willingness to lose. Interestingly, we may once have been much more willing to think about failure in this way. Prior to the 19th century, the historian Scott Sandage has argued, it was rare to hear the word failure applied to an individual. Certain ventures, such as an attempt to run for office or to start a company, might prove to be failures. But the individual behind such an undertaking would be described as having made a failure, not as being one. To have made a failure could be depressing, no doubt, and even sometimes catastrophic. But it was not an across-the-board condemnation of an entire human life. To research his fascinating book, Born Losers, Sandage had to find creative ways around the survivor bias, which ensures that it's usually only tales of success that find their way into historical archives. Cleverly, he had the idea of using begging letters sent to the oil magnate John D. Rockefeller in the late 1800s. Poring over these and other sources solidified Sandage's hunch that the idea that a person could be a failure had sprung directly from the growth of entrepreneurial capitalism over this period. One crucial development, he argues, was the emergence of credit rating agencies, whose role was to sit in judgment upon individuals seeking loans from banks, helping the banks determine the risk they'd be taking by making the loan. In a society increasingly dominated by business, a bad credit rating could all too easily come to be seen as a verdict condemning a whole person. And it's from the language of credit rating, Sandage notes, that we take several modern idioms for describing someone's moral worth, such as good for nothing and first rate. Failure, he writes, became transformed from a bump in the road of life to the place at which the story stops. From the middle of the 19th century onwards, failure started to be thought of not merely as a cataclysm that adds to the plot of your life, but as something that stops your life cold because you lose a sense of your future. Failure, in short, came to be seen as a kind of death. The message of the most radical proponents of the embrace of failure, like Natalie Goldberg, is that it is the exact opposite. The route to a far more vivid, raw, and acutely experienced way of being alive. Most of the conventionally successful people who champion the benefits of embracing failure are making a much less radical claim than Goldberg's. They're talking about learning to tolerate failure only as a means to their eventual success. A rare exception is J.K. Rowling, the stratospherically successful author of the Harry Potter novels, who in 2008 gave a now famous graduation speech at Harvard University on the subject of failure. Of course, it's impossible to know for sure how Rowling would feel about failure if it hadn't been followed, in her case, by spectacular success. But she conveyed the distinct impression that she would have felt the same about it even if she had remained obscure, poor, and creatively unfulfilled. Her words chime with many of the insights of the Stoics, the Buddhists, and others into the benefits of negativity, and they're worth quoting at length. I think it fair to say that by any conventional measure, a mere 7 years after my graduation day, I had failed on an epic scale. An exceptionally short-lived marriage had imploded, and I was jobless, a lone parent, and as poor as it is possible to be in modern Britain without being homeless. The fears that my parents had had for me, and that I had had for myself, had both come to pass, and by every usual standard, I was the biggest failure I knew. Now, I'm not going to stand here and tell you that failure is fun. That period of my life was a dark one, and I had no idea there was going to be what the press has since represented as a fairy tale resolution. I had no idea how far the tunnel extended. So why do I talk about the benefits of failure? Simply because failure meant a stripping away of the inessential. I stopped pretending to myself that I was anything other than what I was, and began to direct all my energy into finishing the only work that mattered to me. I was set free because my greatest fear had been realized, and I was still alive. Failure gave me an inner security that I had never attained by passing examinations. Such knowledge is a true gift, for all that it is painfully won, and it has been worth more than any qualification I ever earned. Chapter 8. Memento Mori. Death as a Way of Life. If I had my life over, I should form the habit of nightly composing myself to thoughts of death. I would practice, as it were, the remembrance of death. Without an ever-present sense of death, life is insipid. You might as well live on the whites of eggs. Inspector Mortimer in Muriel Spark's Memento Mori. At one point during the course of the 200,000-line Indian spiritual epic, the Mahabharata, the warrior prince Yudhisthira is being cross-questioned about the meaning of existence by a nature spirit on the banks of a lake, which is the sort of thing that happens in the Mahabharata all the time. What is the most wondrous thing in the world? The spirit wants to know. Yudhisthira's reply has become one of the poem's best-known lines. The most wondrous thing in the world is that although every day innumerable creatures go to the abode of death, still man thinks that he is immortal. Wondrous is a good way of putting it. Again and again, we've seen how merely not wanting to think certain thoughts or to feel certain emotions isn't sufficient to eliminate them. That's why nobody ever wins Daniel Wegener's White Bear Challenge, why self-help affirmations often make people feel worse, and why confronting worst-case scenarios is almost always preferable to trying to pretend they couldn't happen. But mortality seems a baffling exception to this rule. Death is everywhere, unavoidable, and uniquely terrifying. Yet as long as it's not impinging on us immediately, through recent bereavement or a life-threatening illness or a narrowly survived accident, many of us manage to avoid all thoughts of our own mortality for months, even years at a time. The more you reflect on this, the stranger it seems. We're perfectly capable of feeling acute self-pity about more minor predicaments, at home or at work, on a daily basis. Yet the biggest predicament of all goes by, for the most part, not consciously worried about. At bottom, wrote Freud, sweepingly, as usual, but in this case persuasively, no one believes in his own death. This apparent nonchalance in the face of mortality looks stranger still in light of the fact that we do talk about death all the time, yet somehow without ever really talking about it. Who reads those magazine features listing 100 things to do before you die, places to travel, foods to eat, albums to hear, and pays any real attention to the before you die part? If you did, your reaction might well be a cry of existential despair. Why bother if I'm just going to die in the end anyway? And existential despair, needless to say, is not the response a magazine editor usually wishes to evoke among readers. We're captivated by fictional tales of murder, but the murder in a murder mystery rarely has much to do with the realities of death. Even real deaths in news reports can trigger horror, sympathy, or outrage without once prompting the viewer to reflect that the same basic fate, in a few decades at most, awaits him too. The idea of choosing to think about our own mortality in a personal sense, as a matter of daily conversation, strikes us as hilarious. The joke on which, for example, much of the humour in Woody Allen's 1975 movie Love and Death rests, as in this exchange between the characters Boris and Sonia. Boris, nothingness, non-existence, black emptiness. Sonia, what did you say? Boris, oh, I was just planning my future. One of the most persuasive explanations of this psychological puzzle remains the one put forward in 1973 by Ernest Becker in his magnum opus, The Denial of Death. Another death-fixated Woody Allen character, Alvy Singer, uses a copy to woo the titular heroine of Annie Hall. Becker was born in Massachusetts in 1924. As a drafted soldier, he encountered the worst realities of death while still a young man, helping to liberate a Nazi concentration camp by the time he'd turned 21. The lack of serious thought we give to mortality, for Becker, is no accident or oversight. It's precisely because death is so terrifying and significant, he argues, that we don't think about it. The idea of death, the fear of it, haunts the human animal like nothing else, his book begins. But the consequence is that we dedicate our lives to suppressing that fear, erecting vast psychological fortifications so that we can avoid confronting it. Indeed, an enormous proportion of all human activity, in Becker's view, is designed largely to avoid the fatality of death, to overcome it by denying in some way that it is the final destiny of man. We're able to sustain this denial, he explains, because we possess both a physical self and a symbolic one. And while it is inevitable that the physical self will perish, the symbolic self, the one that exists in our minds, is quite capable of convincing itself that it's immortal. The evidence of this is all around us. In fact, it's so ubiquitous that you might miss it. In Becker's view, all religions, all political movements and national identities, all business ventures, all charitable activity and all artistic pursuits are nothing but immortality projects, desperate efforts to break free of death's gravitational pull. We long to think of ourselves not as mortal humans, but as immortal heroes. Society itself is essentially a codified hero system, a structure of customs, traditions, and laws that we have designed to help us feel part of something bigger and longer lasting than a mere human life. Thanks to our symbol-making capacities, he writes, the single organism can expand into dimensions of worlds and times without moving a physical limb. It can take eternity into itself, even as it gaspingly dies. From this perspective, it isn't only conventionally religious people who depend on the notion of an afterlife. All normally adjusted people, religious or not, unconsciously do so, and every society is thus a religion, whether it thinks so or not. For Becker, mental illness is a malfunctioning of the internal death-denial machinery. Depressed people are depressed because they try but repeatedly fail to shield themselves, as others manage to do, from the truth that they are not, in reality, cosmically significant heroes, and that pretty soon they're going to die. Immortality projects may be the cause of plenty of good things, great architecture, great literature, great acts of philanthropy, great civilizations, but in Becker's view they are simultaneously the cause of the worst things, too. Our urge to think of ourselves as heroes doesn't discriminate. It helps explain why we compete in sports or politics or commerce, but also why we fight wars. War represents the ultimate clashing of rival immortality projects. If my sense of immortality relies on my nation's triumph, and yours upon yours, we'll fight longer and harder than if we were seeking only territory or power. Making a killing in business or in the battlefield, writes the philosopher Sam Keane, paraphrasing Becker, frequently has less to do with economic need or political reality than with the need for assuring ourselves that we've achieved something of lasting worth. Human conflicts are life and death